Good afternoon, Your Honors. Dean Campbell on behalf of the estate of Lucille Osborne, and may it please the court. Would the court like a brief but full recitation of the facts?
I think we're all familiar with the facts, actually.
All right, very, very well. The case that's before the court today is what I often review and refer to my students as being a big picture case. There are certain facts in this case that, considered in the whole, make up the big picture, and we as attorneys are often trained to look at the details. But in this particular case, there are certain facts I think that when we put them together really makes the case, and to miss the big picture results in a logical or perhaps an equitable resolution. I think that is what has happened here. But I want to refer to a few facts that I think are important with respect to this big picture that I'm talking about. The deceased, Lucille Osborne, was a very smart lady. She was an office manager, she was a tax preparer, she was a student. Even in later life, she achieved her associate's degree. In 1984, Lucille and Michael Kemp, the appellee, were complete strangers. Never met before, but Lucille was looking for a tenant, and she found a tenant. $275 a month for the upstairs of this apartment in Slaughter Beach was what they agreed to. For 20 years plus, payments of $275 a month were made by Mr. Kemp to Lucille. Everything that is in the record except for this photocopied document, this photocopied contract, and the unabated testimony of Mr. Kemp indicates that what was being paid was rent. There's no documents referring to anything more than that. And those rent payments continue to be made for 20 years, sometimes late, sometimes in bunches at a time. There was never an increase in the rent.
Excuse me.
Yes, ma'am.
Was it reported as income on her taxes?
Yes, it was. In fact, we entered as evidence. All the tax records were not available from over the 20 years, but what we did introduce at trial, I believe there's one tax return in particular from 2004, which clearly showed rental income, and that's how it was reported as rental income, and it was shown on the rental income form as opposed to any sort of a tax gain.
What about
gain.
Before 2004?
Tax records were missing. We were only able to recover back to then. There was one other document that did come to light, and that was, I believe, from 1987. There was an antenuptial agreement signed by Lucille and her husband, Mr. Menicucci, before they married, in which she did indicate in that antenuptial agreement that she owned the property free and clear and did not report any encumbrances or otherwise with respect to this property. So everything in the record refers to and reports this as being rent. Not until myself as her attorney got involved and sent a five-day notice to Mr. Kemp did this photocopied one-line contract come to light. And, of course, the court has seen and I'm sure read that one line. So 20 years after April 1985, In April of 2005, Lucille is still of sound mind. She's still competent at this point. Mr. Kemp, even after April 2005, pays rent. Lucille accepts rent. Not until the five-day notice and the landlord-tenant code went out did this document come to the surface and Mr. Kemp claimed that he had this rent-to-own agreement. Incredibly, Mr. Kemp never asked to have the transaction completed until after the five-day notice was sent. And, of course, in the end, we know the court, Vice Chancellor Parsons, ruled in appellee's favor.
Was he represented at that point?
At which point, Your Honor?
When he wanted to produce the document and
yes.
Wanted the deed.
Yes, in fact, is in the facts that Sharon Gillespie, Lucille's power of attorney, went to Mr. Kemp in, I believe it was 2006, asking where the rent was, and there was some discussion, and Mr. Kemp at no time brought up this contract. Only after I sent the late notice did Mr. Kemp obtain counsel, and this one-line contract was produced. Probably the most incredible and saddest thing about this big picture that I've painted here is that Lucille never had the chance to say, no, that's not my contract, no, that's not my signature. And we had to defend a specific performance based solely on circumstantial evidence. And, of course, Mr. Kemp was able to testify without you know, without much difficulty as to why certain things transpired like they did. And the other intriguing thing about this case
is, when you say she never had a chance to testify that it was or wasn't her signature, are you suggesting there was no evidence on the record that it was her signature?
The only evidence on the record that it was her signature was Mr. Kemp's testimony that he was present when she signed it. And there was, of course, the notary signature, which is a question. It was not a lawful notary, as indicated in the decision by Vice Chancellor Parsons. And likewise, the notary could not remember who was before her when it was signed. She indicated in her deposition, which was submitted as testimony at trial, that she normally would notarize the bottom signature and place her notary below that. On the document itself is clearly beside Lucille's signature. We had the expert, an expert testify, but because it was a photocopy of the document, he could not be certain.
What does that suggest, that the both signatures were there when she notarized it?
The position, or what we believe had happened, and based on what Ms. Gillespie also testified at trial, was that it was Mr. Kemp's intention from very early in a relationship that he wanted to buy the property. And we believe that this perhaps was an offer that he had, was going to make, had it notarized to show his sincerity. But we were never able to make that case because
Where does this leave us? Didn't the Vice Chancellor make findings of fact? And what's the legal issue before us?
He did. And unfortunately, the contract did get into evidence. The contract was interpreted by the Vice Chancellor, which does bring us to the legal questions before this court. And based on the case law and the Behrens case in particular, it appears that the Court of Chancery should have used a two-prong analysis to decide this case, the first prong being the legal issue regarding was this or was this not a lawful, enforceable contract under the doctrine of specific performance. And secondly, there is a discretionary aspect as a second prong about whether or not it is equitable to enforce the contract or not. We submit, and it is appellant's position, that there are a number of legal irregularities with the document that should have precluded the Vice Chancellor from awarding specific performance. Number one is that the case law is very clear that in a specific performance case of this nature, in the first step of determining if it's a contract, it goes beyond to determine if there's a contract to see if it is an enforceable contract. And the case law that we cited in briefing and the Walton versus Beale case in particular talks about there has to be clear and definite terms, that the terms of the contract, especially with respect to the essential terms being price, land description, and settlement date, have to be clear, and there's no room for interpretation. That's from Walton versus Beale. In another case, which I didn't specifically point out in briefing, that I want to read a passage from that case. This is Chancellor Chandler talking in 2005. He writes, Delaware law recognizes a party seeking specific performance to prove by clear and convincing evidence the existence and terms of an enforceable contract, and the court will not decree specific performance if the contract terms are unclear and indefinite, and there must be no need for the court to supply meaning to the essential terms. And that's from the McKeel versus Solo Company case, 2005, Westlaw 1252348. And Walton versus Beale, which is a decision written by Vice Chancellor Parsons, essentially says the same thing, that there's no room for interpretation. And we would submit to the court, and I think the key question that comes before the court today is in a specific performance case, we have this body of case law that says there's no room for the court to supply essential terms. Does that include interpretation of essential terms? And based on Walton versus Beale and the Solo Cup case that I just quoted from, it appears that there is not. And we would suggest that allowing or permitting the Court of Chancery to interpret those essential terms is, in fact, supplying those essential terms to the contract. And if that is, in fact, permitted in this case, as it was by Vice Chancellor Parsons, it leads to a number of problems down the road with, you know, in this particular case, granted, there were only two potential readings and two potential interpretations of this one-sentence contract. But what about the case in the scenario where there's three or more, or 10, or how many? Where does that bright line end with regard to when is the court supplying essential terms and when is it not?
Well, what essential terms did the judge or the vice chancellor supply here?
The vice chancellor in this case had to supply the price term, and it was supplied through interpretation of the contract. And the difficulty with this case is that Vice Chancellor Parsons acknowledges, I believe it's footnote 97 of the opinion, he acknowledges that the contract is ambiguous. And he very clearly states that in this footnote. But yet, going back at least to 1912, to the case of Mathis versus Weir, and citing to Pomeroy and equity, or Pomeroy on equity, which of course is often cited to by the Chancery Court in this court, that case says that in a specific performance case, the contract must be unambiguous, and especially when dealing with the essential terms like land description and price, the contract has to be unambiguous. And in this particular case, the vice chancellor is saying this contract is ambiguous, but yet specifically enforces it anyway.
Well,
and we would suggest that
by referring to it as ambiguous, that's simply a means, isn't it, to look at extrinsic evidence to determine the actual meaning?
Well,
and once you do that, it's no longer ambiguous, is it?
Yes, Your Honor, I suppose that's correct. But we would suggest also that allowing the court to engage in the interpretation through extrinsic evidence and through parole evidence, that is supplying essential terms. And
Here, didn't the court essentially say, out of the two possible interpretations, I'm going to pick the interpretation that's most favorable to your client? There are only two choices. The one choice is the amount you've been paying these 20 years, that's it. You own the property. The other choice is you pay for 20 years and then you pay $50,000. So the court says, I'm construing this to be you pay for 20 years and then you pay $50,000, right?
That is what the court said, yes.
And how can there be any objection that, the court is providing terms here and all that when, you know, the court has basically done the most it could do for your client? I guess the alternative, as far as you're concerned, is the court could say, well, I can't construe this. But your ambiguity argument is really not an ambiguity. It's a choice, is it?
Well, I would suggest that it was an ambiguity, and, in fact, the vice chancellor said that it was. And, yes, the vice chancellor did construe it in my client's favor, but, frankly speaking, a Slaughter Beach house, whether Mr. Kemp pays $0 for it today or $50,000 for it today, is still a huge forfeiture to my client. And yes, it was construed in my client's favor, but as a matter of law, the court should not have undertaken that interpretation process to get to that point. If the law of specific performance says you can't enforce a specific, or you can't enforce an ambiguous contract, that is what the court's doing, enforcing an ambiguous contract. And that is just a clear error of law on behalf of the vice chancellor.
Well, what's ambiguous about reading this contract to say, as it says, it's an installment contract. You pay $275 per month plus utilities for 20 years, in effect as a contingent precedent for the purchase after a payment of $50,000. What's ambiguous about that?
Because it's one of two different meanings. And the other thing that occurred during trial is that was never.
What would the other sensible, reasonable interpretation be?
Well, the other sensible, reasonable interpretation, I suppose, would be that was propounded by the appellee throughout trial and throughout this entire litigation, and that was that the $50,000 had been paid over the course of 20 years. That was their position throughout trial, and that's the position they went throughout the litigation, and that's the position they went to trial on.
Under our rules, there's no reason lawyers can't advance ludicrous arguments, but what I'm looking at is something that makes perfect sense. If you have any history of installment contracts for the purchase of real estate in Kent and Sussex County, sadly, these kinds of arrangements are not unusual.
Installment contracts are not unusual by no means. And the one-line sentence, however, does leave room for interpretation, as evidenced by the decision. And that other interpretation, as much as we fought against that interpretation, was a reasonable interpretation as well.
Well, wait a second. If we were to hold that the trial court was wrong in finding this contract ambiguous, and that in fact there was really only one reasonable interpretation, especially in light of the fact that if you pay $275 a month for 20 years, you've paid more than $50,000. So let's assume that the trial court should have said this contract is unambiguous. It calls for the payments for 20 years and then $50,000. Would that take care of the problem?
No, I don't believe it would, because we're still left at the end of the day with the contract having two possible meanings. And I'm not sure that...
Well, no, if frequently, the case law on ambiguity is pretty clear, and it says the fact that somebody can come up with a different interpretation for a contract doesn't mean that the contract is ambiguous. There have to be two reasonable interpretations mm-hmm. before you get to that conclusion. And if the trial court erred in finding that the interpretation advanced by your opponents was an unreasonable one and therefore not something that should have been given any credence, then it's an unambiguous contract and it says what it says.
Well, as much as I disagreed below with the appellee's position, their reading of the contract was a reasonable reading, and we did not dispute the fact that either one of these readings would be reasonable. I suppose on remand it could go back, and that could be the order, in which case we're left with an unambiguous contract.
Did you argue below that it was a reasonable interpretation?
I don't know that we ever got to that point, Your Honor. We argued below that the contract was ambiguous, so I suppose in a sense we did argue that there were two reasonable interpretations. In as much as we didn't like the appellee's position, it was still a reasonable position. It was still a reasonable interpretation of the contract. I'd like to move on to a couple of my other points, if I may. The other issue of law that we believe the Vice Chancellor clearly was mistaken with regard to is one of the affirmative elements of a cause of action for specific performance, and again, the case law is very clear on this, is that the party that wants a contract enforced must be ready, willing, and able to perform that contract. And there are two or three places in the decision that say that Mr. Kemp was ready, willing, and able to perform. But clearly, and we pointed this out in briefing, he was not. He was asked specifically, do you have $50,000 if the court interprets the contract that way? He said no. We asked him if he had applied for or had a loan to borrow the $50,000 to purchase the contract if the court interpreted the contract in this fashion, and he said no.
Okay, we review the interpretation of a contract de novo. What's the standard of review on that issue, on the finding that Mr. Kemp was ready, willing, and able to?
That is a factual question. It would be clearly erroneous, but it is clearly erroneous, and the transcript clearly shows the record where Mr. Kemp said he was not prepared. He purchased the property for $50,000, and I think that is very clear in the briefing and in the transcript that's been provided.
Okay. I'm going to save you balance of your time.
I would, Your Honor. Yes, thank you.
All right. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Your Honors.
Good afternoon.
May it please the court.
Let me start with the last point. Was your client asked whether if the court determined that he owed $50,000, would he be able to obtain those funds so as to purchase the property? Was he asked that?
He was asked that, Your Honor.
I assume he answered yes?
He answered that he would be able to obtain the financing, yes.
Thank you.
And with respect to that argument, we have argued in our brief that, and I would like to elaborate on that, really the issue about giving the 90 days for the additional financing, in my opinion, is really a time is of the essence type of question. and did this contract have a time is of the essence clause? And the answer is it did not. And so if it did not have a time is of the essence clause, and it did not have a firm settlement date, which it did not, it just had after you pay for 20 years, we'll convey the property for the and so we don't have a time is of the essence requirement in the contract, so that allows a reasonable time to settlement, and it's our contention that 90 days is a reasonable time to go to final closing after the contract was interpreted. And I think specifically in this case, Mr. Kemp could not possibly have obtained finance, a purchase money mortgage on this property until he had a valid contract. And the contract was not really valid until Vice Chancellor Parsons ruled that there was an enforceable contract and what the terms were. At that point, he could go to a bank and apply for a mortgage, and that would then allow him to obtain financing on that property. But prior to that, he would really have no ability to get a loan on this property. A bank would not loan the money because there would be a cloud on the title. So we feel it's altogether reasonable for the Vice Chancellor to allow Mr. Kemp 90 days to get that financing. The alternative would have been that on the date of trial, he would have had to have the $50,000 plus closing costs with him at that time, or on the time when the decision came out in August by the Vice Chancellor, he'd have to have it at that time. But he really couldn't because it was putting the cart before the horse. Because he could not obtain financing until he had a valid contract.
Is there anything in the record saying what the current value of the property is?
The only the current value of the property, there is nothing in the record as to the current value of the property. And we would contend that appreciation that may have happened after the contract was signed under the Esso case really isn't a factor that the court should look at if it is even going to look into the adequacy of the consideration. At least
so even if balancing the equities between the parties is a role for the Vice Chancellor to play, the value of the transfer at the time he makes his ruling is not relevant?
It is, I don't believe, as relevant as the value of the property when the deal was struck.
Well, when were the improvements to the property made? Before the deal was struck or after?
They were made after. They were made after.
What's the difference between the two?
I believe, at least in the Esso case, the court was looking at the fact that at the time the contract was made, neither party could really envision what might happen with the property value go up or value go down. And so it was believed that the value at the time of the contract is more applicable. The improvements certainly put a different light on that, and if you're going to consider those, then perhaps the value at the time of the conclusion would be appropriate. But there was no evidence really as to the value at the end of the contract, nor any evidence as to the value when the contract was formed.
So there's nothing in the record that would support a conclusion that it would be unconscionable to enforce this?
There is not as to the value at the end of the contract. There was testimony given by Ms. Gillespie at the trial that she pulled a copy of a listing from the Sussex County Records from 1986 for what she alleged to be a similar property. and it was a listing agreement, not a sale. And that the property was listed for about $106,000 at that time, this allegedly comparable property. And Mr. Kemp, under the way the contract was interpreted, would have paid $116,000, although not all at once, but $66,000 over the life of the contract plus another $50,000. And so we would contend that at least when the contract was struck, the values were certainly not grossly disparate. with respect to the ambiguity argument, the standard of review, I believe, is different for both parties. We contend the standard of review under the first argument that was alleged by the appellant is an abuse of discretion standard. And the cases that are cited by the appellant, Scarborough, Honeywell, Barron's, and Peden, all do apply an abuse of discretion standard. So we do contend that would be the appropriate standard of review. And really the first argument, what I think it's important to focus on is...
Are you going to tell us why it's abuse of discretion rather than de novo?
Yes, Your Honor. For example, in the Scarborough case, the abuse of discretion was applied as to the existence or non-existence of an oral plea agreement, and in that instance, the court was reviewing an oral contract and determining that since we're not reviewing contract language, but just whether the existence of an agreement, that it would be an abuse of discretion. In the Honeywell case, it was actually an ambiguous term.
Well, you're not suggesting that we're not reviewing the language of a contract to determine whether the Vice Chancellor interpreted that language correctly or not, are you?
Well, Your Honor, I am in the first argument. I believe that in the way the argument was couched, the appeal, the issue that was raised on appeal by the appellant, his argument is really only this, and that is whether it is error for the Chancery Court to specifically enforce an ambiguous contract. The way the question is presented, he did not appeal the Chancery Court's interpretation of the contract, only whether it was error to enforce an ambiguous contract. And we contend that the case law is pretty clear on that, and that the Chancery Court...
So you're willing to agree that it was an ambiguous contract?
Yes. The Chancellor found it was an ambiguous contract. There were two competing reasonable interpretations of the contract advanced. I believe that creates an ambiguous contract that then allowed extrinsic evidence to come in, which the Chancellor heard, and then the Chancellor reached an interpretation of the contract, which then renders it non-ambiguous, and then it was specifically enforced.
Do you have any other cases to cite where an ambiguous contract was specifically enforced?
Yes, Your Honor. In Walton v. Beal, the court looked at the contract and said that even if aspects of the agreement are obscure, which is ambiguous, same term, the contract can be enforced if the court's able to ascertain the terms and conditions in which the parties intend to be bound. And in that agreement, there was an oral land contract, and there were approximations as to price. It wasn't set forth. And so the court...
Right. Yeah, but the court didn't say in that case, I've got a contract the terms of which are ambiguous, and I am going to first determine what the contract means and then specifically enforce it.
It called it obscure, the terms. But in McDowell versus Greenfield, which was a 2008 decision by Vice Chancellor Lamb, the court specifically said that it determined that the terms of the contract were ambiguous. After reviewing the extrinsic evidence, the court found the payment that the buyer made was a down payment towards the purchase price on land, as opposed to an option, a fee for an option. And then it granted specific performance.
If I understood correctly what you said earlier, Mr. Eby, you said that you advanced a reasonable argument that was different than the other side below, and that made this an ambiguous contract. While generally ambiguous contracts can't be specifically performed, once the Vice Chancellor resolved the ambiguity, it no longer existed, and he could specifically enforce the contract. Is that your position?
Yes.
That's what I heard you say.
Yes. The court concluded in the McDowell case that the master did not supply an essential term, It was faced with two potential readings. The language is right in the agreement.
So let me just follow up with that. So your position would be that Delaware law either is or ought to be that the only time an ambiguous contract cannot be specifically enforced is when the trial judge or the vice chancellor concludes that he can't resolve the ambiguity in the contract, and therefore he can't specifically enforce it. That's the necessary corollary, isn't it?
I'm sure there are some limitations to that, but that is the cases have generally held that if there's an ambiguity, it can be resolved. That once it's resolved, it could be specifically enforced.
Well, is the test whether the court has to supply essential terms or whether the court determines what the parties agreed?
I think that's a key element, and that is whether the court does have to go outside the agreement to supply the essential term, meaning there's no term there whatsoever. For example, if price was not mentioned at all in the contract, I think that's a clear example where the court might be supplying essential terms. But where there is a price in the contract and you're disputing as to what it is, the court is not supplying the essential term. The term's there. It's just interpreting it.
Is a settlement date an essential term in order to specifically enforce a contract for sale of real estate?
Settlement date is an essential term.
Well, didn't the vice chancellor supply an essential term by giving your client 90 days to obtain the financing and the close? Because it's not anywhere on the contract itself.
I believe the contract, although it doesn't have a date for the settlement, the date would be when the last payment was made. And so it would be our position that the settlement date's in the contract. It's after payments are made for 20 years. Now, it doesn't say on this date, April of 2005 or May of 2005, but the court found that the settlement would be after the last payment was made. And so it's our contention that we're not supplying that essential term. You can determine from the agreement when the settlement will be. It's going to be after the last payment.
And when you say last payment, you're talking about the installment payment. You're not talking about the payment of $50,000.
Yes, although the $50,000 payment would be due at the end of the 20 years when this last payment was made.
So 24 hours after the last payment is made and the $50,000 isn't tendered, what do you do about a settlement date?
Did you say 24 hours, Your Honor?
I did. I could have said one day after the last payment was made, but for some reason I chose 24 hours.
I believe that what that brings us to is a contract without a time is of the essence clause, okay. And then a reasonable time would be allowed to go to settlement.
So under your construction of the required settlement date, it would be a reasonable time after final payment was made on an installment contract with the purchase of land?
It would be in a vacuum, but we do have some other issues in the case, and that was that after Mr. Kemp made the last payment, he stopped making payments and had some communication with Mrs. Lucille Osborne in August of 2005, where he discussed with her, according to his testimony at trial, when they could complete the settlement. And supposedly she was going to get around to doing that and never did. And then from that period of time, from his last payment was made in July of 2005, as even though the contract was April, he was made an extra payment. From that time forward until January of 2007, Mr. Kemp remained at the property, occupied it, and did not make any additional payments, thinking he is fully performed and is really waiting to go to settlement because under his interpretation he did not owe an additional $50,000. And so until, you know, he was occupying the property, so until his rights were questioned, he really had no reason to believe that he had anything other than what he thought he had, which was the contract to pay $275 plus utilities for the 20 years. And with respect to the just with respect to the ambiguity, there's also the Heckman versus Nero case, where there was not a discrepancy as to another essential term in the contract, that is the description of the land, and the court held again that the description does not have to be exact as long as it's sufficiently certain to ascertain what the party's intent was, that the court could look at extrinsic evidence to determine what the land was to what quantity of land was to be sold. And in that case, the parties walked the boundaries of the property prior to signing the contract to determine that. The third argument that was advanced on appeal is the whether the balance of equities tip in favor of which party in this instance, and it clearly would be an issue that has to be resolved. For the standard of review, the appellant did not cite one in that particular argument, and it's our contention that the standard of review would be it would be a finding of fact that should be supported if it's supported by the record and a product of orderly and logical deductive process under the Adams versus Jankowskis case. And really the sole attack on this end by the appellant had to do with the consideration that was paid under the balance of the equities. And generally consideration can certainly just be a promise to sell and a promise to buy, as held in the Wolf versus Crosby case, and that can be sufficient consideration to uphold the contract for the sale of land. And normally the court does not look at the adequacy of consideration concerning the purchase price versus the value of the property at the time of the contract, and that was held in the Glenn versus Tidewater case, which is a Chancery case from 1953. Now, the court does say that unless there's the price is not fair, if there's some additional facts such as some unfair advantage or overreaching, that the court can, with all those items, could determine that the consideration was not adequate. But if you do not have those, which were not argued under this prong of the appeal, that just the price alone would not be ground to invalidate a contract for specific performance. I was not able to find any cases in Delaware that invalidated a contract on the grounds of specific performance as to price alone. I think that one of the more cited cases where specific performance was not applied under the balance of equities was in the Morabito case, where a buyer was doing a back-to-back settlement. They were selling a house and buying a house back-to-back. The financing fell through for the purchase, and therefore, when the court looked at it, they felt that it would be unfair to displace the seller because they no longer had a home to go to due to his deteriorating financial condition.
Thank you, Mr. Eby.
Thank you.
I may very briefly, Your Honors. There's not one case has Mr. Eby cited to where an essential term was supplied by the court, where it was specifically performed. Wharton,
In Walton versus Beal, price was not disputed. That was a agreed-upon term. McDowell was a down payment issue, so that was not an essential term.
Well, doesn't this case involve whether or not the rent is a credit or not, and isn't that a down payment issue?
And under one of the interpretations, it would, yes. It would be a condition preceding, I suppose, with respect to the final payment.
Is it your position that the contract shouldn't be enforced as a matter of equity because the price is unconscionable?
Well, that certainly is part of it, yes.
And
part
and,
of,
and did you put in evidence as to what the value of the property is today?
Yes, not today, no. We focused on what the contract was back then. And may I finish responding and then give one last thought?
You can finish responding.
Okay, with responding to that, we put in evidence of what property values were then because the case law directed to looking at the contract at the time it was formed.
So the $106,000 is the comparable price?
Yes, that is correct. The $106,000 was back then, and what we showed during briefing, of course, was that that did not take into account 20 years payment, the time value of money. And it resulted in that ambiguity that now is the subject of this course.
All right, thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and adjourn.